Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Murder in Pleasanton, Tina Fails and the Search for Justice, by Joshua Souchon. Narrated by Joshua Souchon. Preface. I always wanted to complete a journalism project that did not involve baseball, mostly as proof to myself that I could do journalism that did not involve home runs and strikeouts. When Steve Carlson was arrested in August 2011 for the murder of Tina Fails, I thought this was the non-sports assignment I'd been seeking, and I was the ideal person to tell the story. I grew up in Pleasanton and lived six blocks down the street from Tina. I was in the fifth grade and a newspaper delivery boy when the murder happened. I went to the same three schools as Tina. My older sister and some of her childhood friends knew Carlson better than most. The reporting on this book started in September 2011, when I was in San Francisco doing pre- and post-game work for the Los Angeles Dodgers radio network. I met Tina's mother, Shirley Orozco, at her home in Pleasanton. She gave her blessing, supported the project, and provided valuable contact information, and we talked occasionally over the next few years. I also met Katie Kelly, Tina's best friend, and started to understand the layers of this tragic story and why it impacted her so much. Over the next 4 years, I talked to Tina's brother, Drew, her biological father, Ron Penix, stepfather, Steve Fails, and many other family members. The family shared candid, painful, and embarrassing stories. The final book probably doesn't do justice to the full impact Tina's death had on her family and her closest friends. However, without their input, this book either doesn't happen or isn't very compelling. Approaching people was not easy. How do you explain to a total stranger that you're writing a book about a murder from 1984 and the defendant used to be married to her deceased daughter? That's what it was like introducing myself to Janet Hamilton. She proved to be warm and incredibly helpful, and ultimately, she believes stories like these need to be told. I'm forever grateful to Janet and all her daughter's friends in Davis, and to Sarah Whitmire, whose tumultuous relationship with Carlson is heartbreaking. Without their cooperation, I'd have never learned the details about Carlson's time in Davis. Overwhelmingly, the people I interviewed were friendly and accurately shared what they knew compared to what they heard, and their questions helped me ask better questions. I'm grateful to them all. Well over 100 people were interviewed, and I probably emailed Katie Kelly and Stacy Coleman to ask one more question over 100 times. Their patience and guidance were invaluable. Some of the people contacted refused to talk or blatantly lied about their association with Carlson, probably out of shame for what they did back in the 1980s. Two people asked for money and did not accept my counteroffer of a free cup of coffee. Some changed their minds and refused to talk. Some wouldn't talk because it was still too painful. Some felt protective of their neighborhood, which is understandable yet frustrating when you're trying to write a balanced book. 19 months after I started working on this book, I took a new job as the play-by-play announcer for the Albuquerque Isotopes minor league baseball team. For the most part, I'd given up on the book. The trial was delayed so many times, and I was so far removed from California. I didn't think I could write the book properly. Fate is interesting, though. One of my close friends happened to get married in Berkeley the same week that the Carlson trial started in Oakland. I was able to attend the trial. Tina's aunt, Karen Reef, and cousin Kim Reef Boozen encouraged me to finish the book. Still, I needed a publisher. Imagine what the History Press editors must have thought when my proposal came across their desks. A minor league baseball radio announcer in Albuquerque, New Mexico, wants to write a book about a murder in Pleasanton, California that took place in 1984. I'd like to thank Will McKay for believing in me, even though my credentials were unique for a true crime. Commissioning editor Megan Ladisaw is a rising star in the publishing industry. If she can coax this book to completion with me, imagine what she'll do editing future books from professional true crime writers. When you spend 4 years working on a project, the final edits are the most nerve-wracking. Thanks to production editor Katie Stitley for her patience as I flew around the Pacific Coast League in the summer of 2015 and kept tinkering with the manuscript between broadcasts. The Pleasanton Police Department and Alameda County District Attorney's Office were generous with their time. Special thanks to Keith Batt, Bill Eastman, James Knox, Stacy Pettigrew, Dana Savage, and Gary Tollefson in particular. Carlson is mostly estranged from his family. He spent so much time in prison and as a transient that finding people willing to talk for a balanced perspective was nearly impossible. I feel empathy for Carlson's siblings and greatly appreciate elder sister Tanya welcoming me into her home and answering all my questions. I did my best to present his side fairly and accurately. This book is based on police records, courtroom testimony, and the memories of those involved. Because the murder happened over 30 years ago, some inconsistencies will be evident in the sequencing of events by the parties involved. Not every story told to this author was used. The book reflects the most reasonable account of what happened. It was never my goal to prove Carlson innocent or guilty. That was the jury's responsibility. I wanted to explain life in Pleasanton in 1984. Tina's life, Steve's life before and after the murder, the frustration of the police in solving the case, and how this story still resonated with the community 3 decades later. Chapter 1, April 5, 1984. It was the coldest crime scene I've ever seen. Bill Eastman. It was Tina Fales' turn to sit in the front seat of the car on the way to school. Tina was the elder child, a 14-year-old freshman at Foothill High. Her younger brother, Drew, an 8-year-old in the second grade at Donlin Elementary, was in a bratty mood. Drew wanted to sit in the front seat and jumped in the car first. Upset, Tina fired a few choice words at her younger brother. "That," Drew said, "was the last conversation I ever had with my sister." Where to sit in the car was the least of Tina's concerns. Her mother, Shirley, was driving her to school because she had stopped riding the bus. Tina was trying to avoid the neighborhood girls who threatened her, taunted her, and made her life miserable at the bus stop, on the bus, and on campus. As they approached the high school, Shirley asked her daughter, "Do you want to change schools?" Tina shook her head. "Not now. I'll wait until the end of the year, then transfer." Before leaving for school that day, freshman Julie Asplin told her mother that she was staying after school to make up a typing exam. As a result, she'd miss the bus and walk home with her friend Tina Fales. "My mom insisted that I didn't stay after school that day," Asplin said. "She had this horrible feeling that something bad was going to happen. She said, when I grew up and have my own family, I would understand that feeling." It was a busy time on campus. 7 more school days remained until spring break. The senior ball was a few weeks after that. Graduation was roughly 2 months away. The day was filled with tension on campus. Around 10 a.m., woodshop teacher Gary Hicklin heard a loud commotion outside his classroom. Hicklin was told a student was locked in a trash dumpster. Hicklin went outside, unlocked the dumpster, and was startled to see a freshman named Steve Carlson inside. Hicklin immediately smelled alcohol on the student's body. Hicklin observed that Carlson was intoxicated and belligerent. It was an odd interaction. It didn't last long. Hicklin told Carlson to go to the office. Carlson did not. He went in the opposite direction, away from where the classrooms were located on campus, toward the football field, and in the direction of where he lived. Hicklin lost sight of Carlson and went back inside his classroom. "I brought alcohol to school that day, and everybody got drunk, including Steve," sophomore Rob Tremblay said. "He was being stupid to all the girls. All the guys in auto shop, we locked him in there. He was all dirty with food all over him, screaming and yelling. They dropped pot in there or something. We were all silly drunk, and it was easy to coax him into it. Everybody was walking by, kicking it. It echoes in there." Soon thereafter, freshman Andrew Hartlett said he left campus, along with Todd Smith and Alan Buck Rogers, to check on Carlson. They walked off campus to Carlson's nearby house, knowing his parents were out of town. "He was drinking vodka," Hartlett said. "I saw him drinking straight from the bottle." Carlson had the keys to his mother's car. Hartlett said he and Rogers watched while Smith got in the car. Carlson was 16, but didn't have a license yet. Carlson went for a brief joyride around the block. Hartlett said he returned to campus with Rogers and didn't know when Smith came back to school. Additional tension took place during lunch. A group of 3 to 5 girls who had issues with Fales in the past threw rocks at her. They called her Tina the Tuna. When school got out, the girls warned Fales, they were going to kick her ass. The end of lunch meant the start of 5th period. 2 classes remained before school ended. Becky Tantillo was startled to see her friend Fales enter her classroom because she wasn't in that class. "Tina was never late for class," said Tantillo. unaware that rocks had been thrown at Fales minutes prior. But that day, she made it a point to pay me back the money I loaned her so she could eat, and she was late for her class. That wasn't like her. I asked if she was okay, and she said, "I'm fine." But she was being weird that day. I don't know why. She was acting strange. It wasn't like her. Around 12:30 p.m., Assistant Principal Jack Keegan had finished eating lunch with other administrators and made his rounds on campus. He was in the northeast corner of the school, near the farm area, when he spotted Carlson. Keegan didn't have any contact with Carlson other than seeing him walking away from campus, east toward the freeway and where Carlson lived. Tina Fales' final class was geography, taught by Barbara Follenfant. Class ended at 2:20 p.m. Before Follenfant went to the girls' locker room to prepare for the softball team's practice, she talked with Fales for 5 to 10 minutes. The subject wasn't memorable. Follenfant didn't recall that Fales was upset or scared. Fales was supposed to attend detention, which started at 2:30 and was scheduled to end at 3:15. Keegan presided over the detention and noted that Fales never showed up. Fales knew some of the girls who had threatened her earlier in the day were also scheduled for detention. That's possibly why she skipped detention, but not definitely why. What did Fales do next? She didn't take the bus. She didn't immediately walk home. She wasn't expecting her mother to pick her up. She waited on campus. And waited. She waited at least 20 minutes, perhaps as long as 30 minutes, before she started walking home. Maybe she was waiting to see if the girls bullying her had gone to detention and if the coast was cleared to walk home without incident. Maybe she was avoiding other girls who bullied her as well. Maybe she was hoping to see the two girls, face her enemies, utilize her recent foray into karate classes, and have at them. Maybe she did homework or read a book. Or maybe she was just a lost soul, wandering aimlessly around campus, sitting and reflecting in a quiet place, alone with her thoughts. Once she finally started walking home, freshman Dean Studebaker was about 10 to 15 feet behind her. They were both walking east, past the baseball field and away from campus. They didn't interact other than Studebaker casually saying, "Bye, Tina," as he turned left and walked north to his house. Fales walked by the baseball fields and through the empty football field, ducked through a cutout in the fence that emptied onto Astor Court, and turned right onto Muirwood Drive. One street later, she turned left on Lemonwood Way and headed toward the drainage ditch that led to a shortcut that went under Interstate 680 to her neighborhood. Freshman Sean West was walking home in the same direction. West was no more than 5 minutes behind Fales, perhaps 2 minutes. He knew it was Fales and where she was going. Their houses were so close, West could see into the backyard of the Fales house from his bedroom window. Lives were changed by what happened next. Tina had just made the turn and gone down Lemonwood Way, West said. My friend Marty drove by and said, "You want a ride?" I said, "Heck yeah." So I jumped in his Camaro and I took off. It was about 2:50 p.m., perhaps 2:55 p.m. Freshman Weldon Mann and Todd Smith were the next two people to see Fales alive. Mann knew Fales well. They both lived on Virgin Islands Court. Mann was a frequent target of little pranks by Fales and her friend Katie Kelly. They targeted Mann because they both had a crush on him. They would doorbell ditch his house or make a prank phone call. It wasn't malicious. It was two teenage girls trying to get any attention from the popular cute boy who lived on their street. "If I remember correctly, we were riding Todd's moped, but I'm not totally sure," Mann said. "We were down there riding around and scurrying around. We saw Tina. She was walking toward the culvert. I don't know if somebody was yelling at her or what. I remember spotting her and thinking it was odd. It was a little after school, but not real late. We saw Steve Carlson in his front yard about the same time." Mann knew Carlson well. They worked together at a restaurant named Augustus, washing dishes in the back. One night, they got into a fistfight out by the dumpsters. Carlson was on his front yard, Mann said. His parents were out of town. He'd been having during-the-day parties, if I remember right. We spotted him and saw Tina. I looked down at my watch and realized that I was going to be late because my mom was going to pick me up at the top of the school. I was at the bottom of the school. I hightailed it up to the top of the school. I jumped in the car. I looked at the clock. I was on time. My mom said, "Good job." It was 3 p.m. Larry Lovell was a truck driver who spent 30 years driving big rigs up and down the state of California. He'd made stops earlier that day and was now heading south on Interstate 680 to his company's headquarters in San Jose. Sometime between 3:05 and 3:15, Lovell happened to look to his right and notice something unusual. It looked like a person had fallen in a gully just off the freeway. Nobody else was around the body. Lovell wasn't sure what he saw. It was just a quick glance. Lovell didn't want to brush it off. He decided to go back for another look. This required him to continue driving south on Interstate 680 to the next exit at Bernal Avenue, make a left at the stop sign where the off-ramp ends, and another left to get back on the freeway heading north for a little over 4 miles to the 580-680 interchange, circle back around, and continue south again. In Lovell's second trip, he slowed his truck as he approached the location and parked the big rig to the side of what was then a four-lane highway. Lovell got out of the truck, started walking down the steep embankment of the culvert, and noticed the body was covered in blood. Lovell didn't go all the way down to the body. He saw enough to know she needed immediate help. Lovell returned to his truck. He drove south on Interstate 680 again, exited at Bernal Avenue, turned left, and this time drove to the Pleasanton Fairgrounds to find a payphone. Kurt Stoner was the first student to see the body. Stoner was in the detention period that Fail skipped. Stoner was ahead of the other students on his way home. When Stoner saw the body, he didn't stick around or look for the closest house to call 911. Instead, he sprinted home as fast as possible. Stoner was so disturbed by what he saw, his older brother called 911 for him. Sophomores Eric Velm and Jay Delamore were the next to see the dead body. The good friends were also walking home after detention. As they approached the entrance to the culvert, they saw a motionless body. They saw papers and books scattered everywhere, and they saw blood, lots and lots of blood. They slowly walked closer to the body, not knowing who it was, their hearts racing with fear and uncertainty. Velm felt for a pulse. The body was still warm, but he knew the girl was dead. The boys raced out of the drainage ditch, up the dirt path, across the street, and knocked on the front door of 7308 Lemonwood Drive. It was the Carlson house. Nobody answered. The boys then spotted an adult at the house they'd just run past. It was Michael Touvet, who worked a graveyard shift for the City of San Leandro Public Works and was doing yard work in front of his house. Touvet owned the last house on Ashwood Drive, before it turned into Lemonwood Way. Large trees were along the right side of his house, covering the view of the drainage ditch. Touvet saw the boys run past his house and across the street. Now he saw the boys running frantically toward him. They had frightened looks on their faces. They described a girl covered in blood. Touvet asked if she was alive or moving. The boys said no. Touvet called 911 and reported what the boys had told him. The phone calls by Stoner's older brother and Touvet arrived within seconds of each other at 3:27 p.m., just as the truck driver Lovell was flagging down a uniformed officer at the fairgrounds. Senior Tony Fisher was in the garage with his friends a couple blocks down the street on nearby Ashwood Court. Some kid I didn't know on a bike was riding down the street, saw us, and said, "Hey, you see the dead girl?" Fisher said. We thought he was lying, so he took us over. I don't remember if we rode our bikes or walked. We went down there. I walked up toward the body. It was Fisher, Todd Olson, and Todd Smith who saw the body. Fisher estimated he got about 15 feet away. I just remember seeing all her books and papers spread, and just seeing the body laying there. Right when I saw that, that was enough for me. I didn't really want to see the body anymore or get any closer. Smith did get closer because he didn't think it was a real body. He and his brothers used to cover a go-kart in a way to make it look like a dummy. "That's what I thought this was," Smith recalled. "All these holes in this sweatshirt cannot be real. No fucking way. That's fake. We started walking away. Somebody said push on the head. That's fake. In that area, there were these sandbags that were dry. They were the shape of concrete bags. They were stacked up on the embankment. It felt like I was pushing a concrete bag. I pushed one more time. That's when I threw up in my own mouth. That has never left my mind. I cannot erase that picture, as much as I've tried." Back at the fairgrounds, Lovell spotted somebody in a police uniform and waved his arms to get their attention. It was Grace Durrell Dickinson, known as GD or Gracie Dickinson. It was her fourth year working for the Pleasanton Police Department as a parking control officer, better known as a meter maid. A bit frantic, Lovell told Dickinson that he had seen a dead body just off the freeway. Dickinson immediately got on the radio and called the dispatcher. Detective Craig Veteran heard the call from Dickinson on the radio. He was on Division Street, just a few blocks from their location at the fairgrounds. Veteran sped his unmarked car to the fairgrounds and arrived in less than a minute. Lovell explained what he had seen again, this time to Veteran. Lovell climbed into Veteran's car and described the area accurately. It was easy for Veteran to figure out where to drive. Dickinson drove her marked vehicle behind Veteran's. They didn't take the freeway. They sped west on Burnell Avenue, made a right on Foothill Road, and traveled north and then right on Muirwood Drive. The cars turned right on Lemonwood Way and parked at the end of the street. Veteran was the first officer to arrive at the scene. Neighbor Touvet was still in his front yard. He pointed in the direction of the drainage ditch. Lovell remained in Veteran's car. Veteran and Dickinson searched for the body. At first, they couldn't find it. They didn't know the terrain and paths like the kids did. Veteran went to the freeway to look back, trying to get the same view as the truck driver. Dickinson could tell from Veteran's body language exactly when he spotted the body. Veteran isn't graceful for his size, but was able to climb down the steep embankment to the body. Nobody else was there. Veteran felt for a pulse. It was too late. The girl was dead. Veteran instructed Dickinson to secure the dirt path, making sure no other civilians entered the crime scene. Gary Tollefson was the working lead detective on crimes against persons when he heard the call over the radio. He was at police headquarters. It was his birthday. He was getting ready to go home a little early. His birthday plans ended immediately. Tollefson arrived at the crime scene at 3:40 p.m., about 13 minutes after the near simultaneous 911 calls. "She was laying there, all cut up," Tollefson said. "Nobody around. She was pretty cut up, but she was pretty pristine. You could tell the kids were traveling through there a lot. Nothing unusual other than the body. A lot of the cuts were superficial. They weren't real deep." Fales was wearing a black sweater with a purple stripe underneath a purple hoodie and lavender pants. Most of the blood was soaked into her clothes and didn't spill out. Very little blood splattered onto the ground. Tollefson's initial thought for the murder weapon: "My guess is what we call the folding buck knife, probably a 4-inch by 3/4-inch blade. It looked like it was pretty sharp." Police Chief Bill Eastman was in a meeting when the 911 calls were made. He arrived a few minutes after Tollefson. One everlasting image remains of what he saw. "It was the coldest crime scene that I've ever seen," Eastman said. "I've seen dozens of homicides. There was nothing there." Nothing meant no clues. Sergeant Michael Stewart brought a camera kit to the crime scene for Tollefson. As lead detective, Tollefson was in charge of gathering evidence and taking pictures. Tollefson took pictures of the crime scene with his 35mm Canon. He used two rolls of film for a total of 48 pictures. Stewart looked for the murder weapon or any clues. He walked underneath Interstate 680 through the tunnel, reaching the other side. Nothing significant was found. Stewart interviewed Velm and Dallimore together, then truck driver Lovell, and then the trio of Fisher, Olson, and Smith. Above the body, in a tree that was covered in shrubbery, Tollefson spotted a purse. The tree was 8 to 10 feet in height. Tollefson was not wearing plastic gloves. Tollefson would later testify that he did not remember how he got the purse out of the tree. He did not notice any blood on the purse. He was mindful of not getting his fingerprints on the purse. Tollefson recalled holding the purse by the evidence tag he placed on the zipper. He placed the purse inside a brown grocery bag. Detective Don Salisbury's first job was to search for fingerprints. In an area that was mostly dirt and trees, none were available on the chain-link fence or the metal brake that students climbed through to reach the tunnel. When a metal detector was borrowed from the water department, Salisbury searched the chest-high grass area for a murder weapon. He found nothing. It was easy for police to identify the victim. Tina Fales' name was written on two books and papers inside a blue binder, which were scattered around her body. At 3:40 p.m., Detective Robert Fricoli arrived on the scene. Fricoli was provided the name Tina Fales by Lieutenant Dave Freeman and instructed to find out information about her at the school. Fricoli left at 3:43 p.m. He entered the high school's administration building a few minutes later, was greeted by assistant principals Edith Stock and Jack Keegan, and told them there had been a stabbing, and he needed the records of Tina Fales. Stock provided an attendance card and a picture of Fales. Fricoli returned to the crime scene with the identification. Fricoli went back to the high school for a second time to obtain more information. He learned that Barbara Follenfant was the teacher for Fales' last class of the day. Follenfant told the detectives she thought she saw Fales leaving the school in an orange and white Volkswagen bus. Fricoli then returned to the police station and picked up a clergy member to assist with notifying the mother. It was a busy day for Foothill High athletic teams and after-school programs. The track team was off campus in a tri-meet with Monta Vista High and the hosts at Dublin High. The tennis team was hosting Livermore High that day, but there were no tennis courts on Foothill's campus back then. The matches took place at Muirwood Community Park, 1 mile north of the crime scene off Muirwood Drive. The golf team hosted crosstown rivals Amador Valley High at Castlewood Country Club, about 4.5 miles south of Foothill Road. The varsity softball team was practicing on campus. Their field was located at the back of campus, just off Muirwood Drive, less than 0.5 mile from the crime scene. "I remember it was an absolutely gorgeous day," said Joy Irvin, a freshman catcher on the varsity softball team. "It was sunny, clear skies. It's something I remember very vividly because we were standing on the field and heard the police sirens. They were so loud, we all stopped. I wondered what happened. We all stopped and looked in that direction. And then it was like a pause. We kept playing." Matt Sweeney, before becoming the school's most successful varsity football coach, was an assistant coach for the junior varsity baseball team. Sweeney distinctly recalled seeing and hearing police cars coming into the nearby neighborhood. Practice was almost over anyway, and they didn't stop. It wasn't until practice ended that they learned a student had been murdered. The marching band was in Orlando, Florida that week for a prestigious competition and would take 6th place nationally. The number of athletic teams playing games off campus and the band being out of town was significant. It meant fewer students were taking the shortcut home that day. Fewer students were hanging out around campus to watch the games. The band wasn't practicing on the nearby football field. No other adults or coaches or umpires were on campus for a sporting event. The campus was unusually quiet. That also meant fewer people were around to witness the killing or prevent it from ever happening. It proved to be the ideal day for a murder to take place so close to a busy high school. But given all those bodies going in so many directions, and given the unpredictability of students on any given day, especially when sports are involved, you would be foolish to plan a murder in that spot, in that time, and on that day, and feel like nobody would see it. It was a complete fluke that nobody saw the murder. Amy Carlson and her friend Lisa Benham stayed after school at Wells Middle School in Dublin. Amy had a theater rehearsal. Lisa stayed to get help in computers. Benham recalled that Tanya Carlson, the elder sister of Amy, was supposed to pick them up from school. When she didn't show up, the 7th grade girls called from a payphone. Tanya told the girls a murder had taken place across from the house, and she couldn't pick them up. Another parent ended up giving the girls a ride. They arrived home sometime after 4 p.m. By that time, police cars were all over the streets. Some neighborhood mothers told their children to stay inside so they wouldn't be accused of something incorrectly. On the other side of Interstate 680, in the Valley Trails neighborhood, 8-year-old Drew Fales was riding his bike on the court of the family's Virgin Islands home. It was about 4:45 p.m. His sister wasn't home from school yet. That was unusual, but not totally unheard of. The previous day, Tina hadn't gotten home until about the same time. She told her mother that she was at the Stone Ridge Mall, which was uncommon. Fales was not into shopping. Usually, Fales came straight home from school and watched soap operas. Recently divorced single mother Shirley Fales cleaned houses on the side for extra money. She had cleaned 2 or 3 that day. Shirley told Drew that she was going to the bank at Valley and Hopyard. She'd return in 15 to 20 minutes. "Right after she left, I saw the unmarked car come down the street," Drew said.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?